Then the oak door opened again, and the guard stepped smartly aside, and a woman came out. She was Richard Beck's mother. No doubt about that. No doubt at all. She had the same slight build and the same pale face, the same long fingers. She was wearing jeans and a heavy fisherman's sweater. She had wind-blown hair and was maybe 50 years old. She looked tired and strained. She stopped about 6 feet from the car, like she was giving me the opportunity to realize it would be more polite if I got out and met her halfway. So I opened the door and slid out. I was stiff and cramped. I stepped forward, and she put out her hand. I took it. It was ice cold and full of bones and tendons.
"My son told me what happened," she said.
Her voice was low and sounded a little husky, like maybe she smoked a lot or had been crying hard.
"I can't begin to express how grateful I am that you helped him."
"Is he okay?" She made a face like she wasn't sure.
"He's lying down now."
I nodded, let go of her hand. It fell back to her side. There was a short, awkward silence.
"I'm Elizabeth Beck."
"Jack Reacher."
"My son explained your predicament."
It was a nice, neutral word. I said nothing in reply.
"My husband will be home tonight. He'll know what to do."
I nodded. There was another awkward pause. I waited.
"Would you like to come in?"
She turned and walked back into the hallway. I followed her. I passed through the door, and it beeped. I looked again and saw that a metal detector had been installed tight against the inside jamb.
"Would you mind?"
Elizabeth Beck asked. She made a sort of sheepish, apologetic gesture toward me and then toward the big, ugly guy in the suit. He stepped up and made ready to pat me down. "Two guns," I said, "empty, in my coat pockets." He pulled them out with the kind of easy, practiced moves that suggested he had patted plenty of people down before. He laid them on a side table and squatted and ran his hands up my legs and then stood and went over my arms, my waist, my chest, my back. He was very thorough and not very gentle.
"I'm sorry,"
Elizabeth Beck said. The guy in the suit stood back, and there was another awkward silence.
"Do you need anything?"
Elizabeth Beck asked. I could think of a lot of things I needed, but I just shook my head. "I'm kind of tired. Long day. I really need a nap." She smiled briefly, like she was pleased, like having her own personal cop killer asleep somewhere would relieve her of a social pressure.
"Of course. Duke will show you to a room."
She looked at me for a second longer. Underneath the strain and the pallor, she was a handsome woman. She had fine bones and good skin. 30 years ago, she must have been fighting them off with a stick. She turned away and disappeared into the depths of the house. I turned to the guy in the suit. I assumed he was Duke. "When do I get my guns back?" I asked. He didn't answer, just pointed me to the staircase and followed me up. Pointed to the next staircase, and we came out on the third floor. He led me to a door and pushed it open. I went in and found a plain, square room paneled with oak. There was heavy old furniture in it. A bed, an armoire, a table, a chair. There was an oriental carpet on the floor. It looked thin and threadbare. Maybe it was a priceless old item. Duke pushed past me and walked across it and showed me where the bathroom was. He was acting like a bellboy in a hotel. He pushed past me again and headed back to the door.
"Dinner's at 8, he said.
Nothing more. He stepped out and closed the door. I didn't hear a sound, but when I checked, I found it was locked from the outside. There was no keyhole on the inside. I stepped to the window and looked out at the view. I was at the back of the house, and all I could see was ocean. I was facing due east, and there was nothing between me and Europe. I looked down. 50 feet below were rocks with waves foaming all around them. The tide looked like it was coming in. I stepped back to the door and put my ear against it and listened hard. Heard nothing. I scanned the ceiling and the cornices and the furniture very carefully, inch by inch. Nothing there, no cameras. I didn't care about microphones. I wasn't going to make any noise. I sat on the bed and took my right shoe off, flipped it over and used my fingernails to pull a pin out of the heel, swiveled the heel rubber like a little door, and turned the shoe the right way up and shook it. A small black plastic rectangle fell out on the bed and bounced once. It was a wireless email device. Nothing fancy. It was just a commercial product, but it had been reprogrammed to send only to one address. It was about the size of a large pager. It had a small, cramped keyboard with tiny keys. I switched the power on and typed a short message. Then I pressed Send Now. The message said, I'm in. It was a wireless email device. Nothing fancy. It was just a commercial product. But it had been reprogrammed to send only to one address. It was about the size of a large pager. It had a small, cramped keyboard with tiny keys. I switched the power on and typed a short message. Then I pressed Send Now. The message said, I'm in. Chapter 2. Truth is, by that point, I had been in for 11 whole days, since a damp, shiny Saturday night in the city of Boston, when I saw a dead man walk across a sidewalk and get into a car. It wasn't a delusion. It wasn't an uncanny resemblance. It wasn't a double, or a twin, or a brother, or a cousin. It was a man who had died a decade ago. There was no doubt about it, no trick of the light. He looked older by the appropriate number of years, and was carrying the scars of the wounds that had killed him. I was walking on Huntington Avenue with a mile to go to a bar I had heard about. It was late. Symphony Hall was just letting out. I was too stubborn to cross the street and avoid the crowd. I just threaded my way through it. There was a mass of well-dressed, fragrant people, most of them old. There were double-parked cars and taxis at the curb. Their engines were running and their windshield wipers were thumping back and forth at irregular intervals. I saw the guy step out of the foyer doors on my left. He was wearing a heavy cashmere overcoat and carrying gloves and a scarf. He was bareheaded. He was about 50. We almost collided. I stopped. He stopped. He looked right at me. We got into one of those crowded sidewalk things where we both hesitated and then both started moving and then both stopped again. At first, I thought he didn't recognize me. Then there was a shadow in his face. Nothing definitive. I held back, and he walked across in front of me and climbed into the rear seat of a black Cadillac DeVille waiting at the curb. I stood there and watched as the driver eased out into the traffic and pulled away. I heard the hiss of the tires on the wet pavement. I got the plate number. I wasn't panicking. I wasn't questioning anything. I was ready to believe the evidence of my own eyes. 10 years of history was overturned in a second. The guy was alive, which gave me a huge problem.